As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Gen 3 delays and deliberations ahead of decisive debut. Tax Zone tweaks to provide race format twist for 2023. FIA Bigwig gets top Mahindra gig, and we're joined by special guest, the XL Exceller. Hello and welcome to the latest Formula E podcast from The Race. My name is Andrew Vandenberg, and this week I'm delighted to welcome Avalanche Andretti driver Jake Dennis. Welcome to the show, Jake.
Thank you for having me, guys. Appreciate it. I've listened to a few, so yeah, happy to be on.
Well, in that case, you'll know the format, and joining us as ever is our man in the Formula E paddock, chomping at the bit to see the Gen 3 cars in action. It's Sam Smith. Sam, we're going to return to our traditional opening gambit. So when did you first become aware of Jake and his racing driving exploits, and what did you make of his first couple of seasons in Formula E?
Yeah, I reckon I saw Jake first in F3, probably back in 2015 when he was with Prema. I think that was his Prema year. But the first time I really remember him properly in terms of what he delivered was at Le Mans a year later when he raced for Jota. I've known the Jota guys for 20-odd years. I'm particularly Sam Hignett and Bob Friend. They're mates of mine. So I clearly remember Sam. Exactly, yeah. I clearly remember Sam being very complimentary about Jake and sort of really happy with his performance at Le Mans that year. And he delivered despite them not getting a finish, which is, you know, a bit of a rarity for Jota. But yeah, then he had some really good DTM performances, didn't he, before coming to Formula E. Never seemed to me to be on the Formula E radar, and I think it was much as a surprise to Jake that he did get that seat. But, you know, there was a lot of curiosity on how he might get on in Formula E, but, you know, we've seen drivers before really struggle to break through in Formula E and understand it and get to grips with it and excel. And, you know, Jake was the complete opposite of that. You know, he was at the races from the very beginning, pretty much. But you have to say, he made that impression, and while there were many that were sort of shocked by how good he was in Formula E, personally I wasn't, because as I said, I knew some top people who've worked with him before, and his skill and dedication was never in doubt. So yeah, I'd say he's been probably the best rookie in Formula E. Maybe, you know, Jean-Éric Vergne in season one, you know, it's a different challenge back then, but coming in during halfway through a rule set as Jake did with BMW iAndretti in 21 and excelling the way he did, yeah, I mean, exceptional, really. So he's one of the top performers in the championship. I don't think there's any doubt in that.
Well, that's quite a build up Sam's giving you there, Jake. But let's just go back to that career that you were in just before you came to Formula E. You were working for Red Bull in the sim, doing some GT3 racing, but from those of us sitting afar, you didn't really appear to be having many options to race at an international level. So what was your reaction when you got the BMW call to test a Gen 2 car and then the full-time drive?
Yeah, I'd be lying if it wasn't a shock for everyone, you know. It was obviously a bit of a call-up, a shock. Like, we only really had, like, one link into BMW, and that was the chief engineer from Arden back in 2016 when I raced for them. He was like the chief energy guy, and was obviously went to all the races and stuff. And he said, Sims is leaving. There's an opportunity for you to come in and give it a good go. So, but I knew sort of DTM was ending, and BMW had around about six of their best drivers also wanting the seat. So it sort of started off with a simulator day, and that was against Nick Gellerly at the time. And they were just evaluating, you know, their drivers. It wasn't really a head-to-head against Nick or anything like that, but it was just a general evaluation. Thankfully, I'm pretty good at simulators. You know, it's something which I enjoy at home, but also I've just been involved with Red Bull for like 4 years now, and then I was with Williams for around about 3 years before that. Generally simulators are something I'm quite good at, and it's generally a way for teams to evaluate you now, so that's always a positive. And that went very well, and then it was like me against the other six to actually get the seat. And ultimately they gave me a test at Verano. I sort of just rocked up, didn't really know what to expect, and Max Gunther was the sort of baseline. It was just me and Max there. The other five drivers or six drivers had already done their tests. And long story short, it basically came down to me and Sheldon, and they put him in for the final test before Valencia. So I thought, okay, well, that's me done then. I'm not really going to get another opportunity to show myself. And to be honest, I could see why they wouldn't choose me. I could see a lot more reasons why they wouldn't choose me over choosing me. The only thing I had in my pocket was that I was fast, but I'm sure the other guys were as well. But they also, you know, bringing me in from Aston Martin and then paying me a salary when they already need to pay six other drivers and fill them up with a seat was always going to be a challenge. But Mike Crack rang up Fraser, my management, and said, we want Jake in the seat for the season. So something I'll thank Mike on is that he just wanted the fastest guy in the seat. And he really didn't pay much attention to the guys above him, you know, the head. I would imagine they were all just saying, just take one of the BMW guys. It's not going to be that much different. And Mike was obviously just the pure racer he is. Chose me, and in the end it paid off. You know, we had a great season, and I have every right to thank Mike and also BMW in general, but yeah, definitely Mike. You know, he went against everyone and took the risk, and it worked out.
I mean, that's an amazing battle against the odds there, really. So yeah, with that in mind, did it sort of surprise you how well that first season went, you know, wins in Valencia, London, and being right in the heart of the title fight all the way down to the wire?
Yeah, definitely, you know, especially as how badly the start of the season went. It wasn't as bad as it looked, but yeah, we were like round five and I had no points on the board. It was just through bad luck and a little bit of not being generally quick enough, I would say. But yeah, there was times which, you know, there was points what clearly should have been won. You know, I think Rome was a standout weekend where FP1 went very well. I think I was top eight, considering I'd never been there, so I felt confident. And then I was doing practice starts on the start line, like everyone else was. And then Oliver Turvey forgot we were doing practice starts and completely destroyed my car when I was sat there stationary, and he hit me at, I don't know, 150K. So that was a bit disappointing. And then sure enough, that qualifying session, which I was meant to take part in, was a drying track. And obviously, with the group I was in, it basically was a guaranteed super pole, you know, approach. And went to pull away in the pit lane. The guys did a great job fixing the mechanical side of the car. Yeah, went to do my qualifying, and it wouldn't start. Basically, the software was still damaged or something like this, and I had to basically miss a guaranteed top six start, and it was just stuff like that at the start of the season which really like hindered us. And then it all turned around basically from when that first win at Valencia. It obviously gave me the confidence. We won a race which everyone says it's impossible to lead because the toe was so big. But yeah, we led from start to finish and got my first win in Formula E. And then my confidence just grew massively. I believed more in myself again and the team, you know, me and my engineer. And it was such a big, weirdly enough, it was actually quite a big divide between me and Max. Not so much in, nothing like in terms of we were hiding stuff, but it was more just like different styles of driving. Like the car setups were massively different. And not always to my knowledge, to be honest. I was always like, at the end of the weekend, I was like, oh, wow, like I didn't realize how far different they went. So it was always difficult to compare data, especially back then with the tire situation. You know, so some people running like hot tires on the rear, cold tires on the front at certain parts of testing. So when you look at the data after the practice, you couldn't really take too much into it and look too much into it. So it was difficult. And both engineers had a very different approach to how they approached the weekend. So it was really hard to learn off Max. But yeah, then we turned it around and obviously got the win in London, pole position at Valencia. And then we were just constantly and deserved like top fives. You know, we had two top fives in Mexico, Berlin. So yeah, then obviously the disaster struck on Sunday, but nevertheless, it was a great season.
So Sam, that's a pretty bold statement. The best rookie season ever. What was it about what Jake did that led you to that conclusion?
Well, just picking up from what I said earlier, that coming in midway through a rule set is never easy. But then again, you know, there was the bit of yin and yang as well, because he also got some, let's say, favourable or slightly favourable qualifying groups, depending on the circuit, with that old tombola system we used to have of going qualifying. But still, as he said, Valencia, and I remember saying this when we did a pod with Jack Nicholls, who didn't share the same opinion, that his victory was one of the best that season. And I said that because I remember pretty much everyone on that grid pre-race was saying they didn't want to lead that event at all, you know, at any stage. It was whoever was going to be at the front was going to, you know, wasn't going to make it through the energy, through what energy they had, and the fact that there was a chance the race was going to go be variable on the lap. So, you know, when he converted that pole to victory, and then kicked on, and as he's just described, accrued all those points and was in contention after that great win in Excel, and he's in contention for the title. For any rookie, I mean, no rookie's ever done that in Formula E. You know, Oliver Rowland had a really good debut season in 2018-19 and got a bunch of poles, but he didn't win a race. You know, he didn't win a race to the season after. I just, you know, I thought it was pretty exceptional. And don't forget, you know, Max Gunter's won three E-Prix. And, you know, Max is no slouch, as Jake knows. He's on his day. He's capable of winning races. So that said, he got the better of his teammate. He brought the car home. I don't remember, actually, in his two season, many shunts. Yes, there's been the usual, you know, rubbing his racing thing of Formula E, and there's been plenty of contact. But I don't remember him dropping it. And the only shunt I recall really was the one that wasn't his fault when he, as he said, Turvey took a few out at Rome. So, you know, could he have won that title? I don't know. I think De Vries on the day might have had things covered. But Jake was in a very good position on that restart. And that real nightmare scenario did play out, and it was unfortunate. But I think to even be in contention, although it will be no compensation for him now, but even to be in contention for a title in his first season, from where he came from with minimal testing, it was really, really impressive. So without doubt, the best debut season I've seen in Formula E.
So Jake, you went from taking the championship to the wire at Tempelhof, which is, of course, also BMW's final race. So going into last season, things were changing within the team, no direct factory involvement, but you stuck it on the podium in Riyadh. So how quickly did you gel with the new setup there, and what was your role in helping to bring the new team together?
Yeah, it was a very different role, to be honest, from my first year to my second year. And honestly, I think making the podium in Riyadh was probably one of the worst things we could have done in terms of just the expectation we set.
Right.
From that point was then so high, like, to then, like, well, if this is our first race together, you know, with all, with some really key personnel leaving from BMW, from the, like, the energy side, and people like that, was a big thing for us. And it was great that it gave us confidence in terms of, like, okay, we can do this. But then the next five rounds were a bit of a slap in the face, to be honest. Like, we went to Mexico and we were just straight up slow. We were not fast at all. I felt like I did, honestly, one of the best laps I've done in Formula E, and I qualified 16th. And in FP1, I said to my engineer, I was like, I've somehow fluked that lap, but my lap in FP1 was very good. And he's like, okay, you're about 8 tenths off, but I was 9th. And I was like, okay, all right, fair enough. And then sure enough, when everyone sort of just built up to it, FP2, I was then like 13th. And then qualifying, me and Oliver were just absolutely nowhere. And then sure enough, in the race, it was just an absolute disaster weekend. And we just had no pace whatsoever. And it was like back to the drawing board. And to be honest, like, I think for the package we had, you know, we had no development from 2021 to 2022. We did a great job in the next four rounds in terms of extracting everything what we had. We were still fundamentally lacking pace, but just the way, especially my car crew with my engineer who was brand new to Formula E that year, and then my data engineer Roman, just what we extracted from the package we had was just was exceptional, really. Every run, every practice session, every quali and race, I genuinely believed, give a position or what we extracted, where we qualified was always quite good. But it was quite evident that in the race and in the efficiency, everyone had taken a step forward from 2021. And it was just a matter of survival in the races. But, you know, we picked up quite a few top tens, but it was always like 8th to 10th. And even if I'd have the race of my life, we just didn't have the pace to match, you know, the likes of Mercedes, Venturi, DS and Jaguar. So if both teammates, you know, delivered on that day, then I would generally pick up a P8 or P9. And I felt like that was the best we could do. And then it was only really towards the end of the season where the tracks played a bit more in our favor. You know, London's not really an energy limited race, and neither is, I can't remember the track now, but in South Korea, it was in Seoul. Yeah, that was it. It was very much quite a fast race. Obviously, one of them was wet, and then the second one was, you know, just a damp track, I believe, but it was a very quick race and not much energy was needed. So, you know, we picked up a lot of points. The car was fast. And, the team did a great job to turn things around to just deliver an even quicker car in qualifying. And then, we obviously had 3 out of 4 podiums in the last 4 races. And I don't think we qualified outside the top 5. So, it was a very strong turnaround from the team. And it gave me, I had so much confidence going into qualifying. With the car I had, it was very good. So that's such a big thing in Formula E, and probably more than any other championship I've ever experienced. I would imagine in anything, even compared to Formula One, because you literally have about 5 useful laps in FP1 and FP2 to learn stuff regarding just pure performance. So if the driver has the confidence on that one lap in qualifying, you can generally extract a couple of tenths in just that. Whereas the likes of other championships, you've got, you know, FP1, FP2, FP3, and they're all an hour and a half long, or they're all an hour long, and you're generally not arriving at different speeds. You know, you're always approaching and braking at the same point. Whereas in Formula E, you know, some laps you'll arrive 20K quicker and some laps you'll arrive 20K slower because you're doing energy runs. So I feel like that was a really big part for myself, and something which I'll hopefully I can take it forward into next season.
Absolutely. Sam, we sort of the narrative around last season was the fight between Evans, Van Dorn, Jev and a few others. But Jake's end of season form really made him, you know, the form guy. Do you think with a bit more luck, he could have been a contender?
I think it's probably a stretch to say that he could get in that battle going into Seoul. As Jake said, there were races like Mexico. I don't think Marrakesh was great. But equally, you know, they had some really great races. Diriyah, as Jake mentioned, obviously London, where he was pretty imperious. New York was reasonable, some decent points. Jakarta and the Seoul, the finale, was really good for Avalanche Andretti. But I think I ranked him fourth in the season review pod we did with Gary Paffett. So I think that's about right. You know, I think a crack at the title was... it wasn't quite there. And I think for the reasons that Jake mentioned, that the team was recalibrating, plus there were tracks where it just wasn't suited as much in the consistency side of things as Mercedes and Jaguar. Although, you know, having said that, Jaguar kind of tanked at Berlin, didn't they? So, I think he finished sixth in the championship. I think fifth might have been a bit fairer, but Degrassi, you know, he got a fair few points in the last few races. That great race he had with Jake in London, the second race as well. So, but for me, like I said before, the lack of errors, that really stands out from last season. I think in battle, he's learnt quite a lot, because I remember in the opening races of his first season, he was, I don't think shocked, but I think he was kind of, he realised he had to get his elbows out a bit more, which he did. And, you know, last season, London apart, Seoul was, I thought, really impressive. You know, the way he got that podium, despite a penalty after that Da Costa contact, a harsh penalty, I think that's that goes without saying. But to knuckle down and get the necessary gap to get that podium was a great race for him. On the whole, is 2022 was every bit as good as 2021, and actually maybe it was even better, because he was, you know, so far ahead of his teammate. And okay, his teammate was a rookie, which Jake knows what it's like being a rookie, but again, he was a good chunk quicker than Oliver Askew, and he also just seemed to make things happen in the race, and that's what you had to do in Gen 2 Formula E racing. You had to make things happen, and he did. So yeah, fair play for another good season.
Jake, talking about Oliver, you two seem to get on well. Are you gonna miss him?
Honestly, yeah, he's a great guy. To be honest, I never really not get along with my teammates. I'm the last person who will ever play mind games. I really don't ever see the point of it. I feel like if you're just quicker than them the whole time, you'll mentally destroy them anyway. But I just feel like with Oliver, he was a great guy, always wanting to learn. And it was good. Like, his feedback was honestly really good. It was always the same as mine. It wasn't like we were going massively off tangent against, you know, he's got this balance, I've got this balance. So he brought value to the team. It was just a shame. He just wasn't quite quick enough. But it was, he showed towards the end of the season that he could definitely perform. You know, I think he qualified this season, quite a lot towards the end of the season. And he started to build confidence and trust the car a lot more. And to be honest, after doing an IndyCar test, I would say, and one of the biggest things he struggled with was the braking in Formula E. It's so unique and so different to anything else you drive in your junior career. And he's obviously driven a lot in America. And after driving the IndyCar, I understood it anyway, but I can now understand it even more, of how far different the cars are. It's literally centuries apart in terms of, you've got this raw beast of a car, of IndyCar, where it's just heavy, it's got a load of power, and it's got some downforce. And you just sort of just rag it, you know, you just get hold of the thing and just send it. Whereas Formula E is so the opposite to that. You know, it's all about finesse, it's all about software. It's such a unique way you brake, and you just don't, I feel like if you just did years of IndyCar or years of just smashing the brake pedal, you can't develop, or you don't have that finesse braking in your toolbox directly. And it was only really towards the end of the year he sort of learned that and, you know, could do a much, much better job for the team and himself. And I feel like the second year, he would have definitely been a good teammate for myself. But obviously the team made their decision and obviously they brought in Andre, which I think is a great step forward for the team in terms of, you know, experience. You know, you've got a guy who is raced in Formula E for a decent time, obviously not a massive amount, but obviously his career itself speaks volumes. And I'm just looking forward to learning off him in just the way he approaches a weekend. You know, I think a guy with that sort of experience will teach me a lot in terms of that aspect. I think lap time wise, I'll very much hold my own and be confident that I'll be just as fast as him. But it's just the way he approaches a weekend, I think, is going to be very interesting, and how he speaks to his engineers and really build the team around him. I'm very much looking forward to learning that off him. And he's a great guy. I'm really good friends with Andre. He's a top bloke. So very much looking forward to working with him in 2023.
He's a bit of a contrasting figure, isn't he, Andre? Because he's a lovely bloke away from the track, but on track, he's about the most uncompromising character you're going to come across.
Yeah, that's why I'm quite looking forward to having him as my teammate, because obviously that won't happen next year. Yeah, we definitely had... It was actually Saudi race one where it was so difficult to pass him, but nevertheless, I got the job done eventually, but it did cost me a fair amount of energy and lap time. But yeah, I think Antonio is not best friends with him on track, to say the least.
Bit of a quick diversion to talk about that IndyCar test. You did it at Sebring, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah.
And what a track to drive an IndyCar in. I imagine you felt the bumps in that.
Yeah, it was such an unreal experience, to be honest. It was that and a Formula 2, which I obviously have no desire to drive now, but that was really the last single-seater for me, which I hadn't driven. You know, I've driven some really good cars. I've driven like World Series, obviously Formula 1, and IndyCar for me was like the last one to the puzzle. And I didn't really know what to expect. My approach to it was very relaxed. You know, I just signed a multi-year deal with Andretti in Formula E. So I knew I wasn't going to IndyCar, and I don't really have a massive amount of interest to ever race in IndyCar. So I just approached it in a very relaxed and just try and enjoy it. And the team sort of wanted to know how I would approach it, because if I just rocked up and said, I want to be the fastest guy out there and just give me all the new tires and give me the fastest setup, it would have been a not very useful test, for them at least. So I just said, look, I don't really care about lap time. Let me have a bit of fun, but if we need to test stuff, then we'll test it. And we very much took that approach. You know, we had a lot of damper work to get through, a lot of ride height stuff. So it was very much a test for them and a bit of fun for me. And that's exactly what it was, to be honest. And yeah, very thankful to obviously Michael. It was great.
So you're telling, I know the calendars don't allow this, but you're telling me if there was some way they were putting an Indy road course, Indy 500 package on you, that's not something you're interested in. I'm not sure I believe you.
An Indy 500, definitely not. I'd much rather spectate, to be honest. I do really want to go to one, and I would love to go. Unfortunately, it clashes this year. I've already looked,
yeah,
which is a great shame. So I do just want to be a fan, and, you know, obviously be pit side and see what it's all about. But
oh no, you've got to stand on the outside of turn one when they come around for qualifying. Yeah. 240 miles an hour into there. There's nothing else like it in motorsport.
That is definitely something I would love to be a part of, for sure. But yeah, like, I actually left the test thinking even more secure that I made the right decision to sign a multi-year deal with Andretti in Formula E. Obviously, I think if Michael and myself really wanted to align and both do IndyCar, he could probably do something about it. But nevertheless, I'm very happy with where I'm at with Formula E, and excited to work with Formula E, you know, to build and be involved in a bigger and better future, for sure.
So Sam, Andretti have got Porsche power, Jake and Andre Lotterer next season. That sounds like a pretty potent combination to me.
Yeah, it's strong, isn't it? I think one of the strongest lineups in Formula E for next season. I actually see, you know, Jake talking about Andre there. I see a little bit of a young Lotterer in Jake, actually. I mean, I've followed Andre's career, as you have as well, VDB, for so many years. I think probably between us, we've seen Andre drive everything, maybe apart from that Caterham F1 cameo, potentially.
Yeah, wasn't it that Spa that year, but probably everything
yeah,
else.
But yeah. Everything else, you know, he's a bit like Jake. He's driven such a diverse array of cars. You know, I think that just only helps a professional driver, doesn't it? And get the skills and the little secrets that they can use in other disciplines. So, you know, I still can't believe Lotterer hasn't won an E-Prix, which is, you know, ridiculous when you look at his stats, particularly in qualifying over the last two seasons. I mean, forget about the last half of 2022, which was a disaster for Porsche, as we know. But actually, the first half of the year and in 2021, he was pretty much top of the tree in terms of his average qualifying position. So he still got it. He's never got the rub of the green in the races, which we know. But I think in terms of that team, you've got obviously the young charger in Jake and Andre's experience and the way that he goes about his racing. I just think it's a nice squad. You know, I think in terms of the personalities, you know, I've never heard a bad word said about Andre Lotterer from a team member, an engineer, team boss or whoever. As you said, some of his competitors have got slightly different opinions sometimes when he's in battle, but there you go. As far as I know, he's never been a overtly political guy, which tallies with you know, which matches Jake and the way he operates. So I can only see it being a good thing, actually. And obviously Andre's affinity and his knowledge of how Porsche works is going to be key. You know, that is a massive boost for Avalanche Andretti for next season, because the level of experience that Andre has and the way that he goes about his business in Formula E and just racing generally can only be a positive thing for Andretti. So again, a lot of it mirrors Jake's approach to racing. So I see it as a great addition to the team, you know, just concurring with what Jake said. But the key thing is that fact of getting Porsche power, because as we know, Porsche have got a hell of a lot to prove after, let's say, at best a mediocre season last season, and then despite some flashes, you know, not delivering on that promise. And one thing I know about following Porsche in the last 20 years in sports car racing in particular is that they don't like losing. You know, it hurts when they're not winning. So that is that should be a major boon for Andretti as we head into Gen 3.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
So, Jake, yeah, two huge changes for the coming season. Obviously, the switch to Porsche power, but obviously the new car as well. I think you've done a couple of days in the development car, haven't you? So what have you made of both working with Porsche and the new car?
Yeah, obviously, working with Porsche, the biggest thing is just learning the software. That's really the biggest change. Actually, all the guys there seem very easy and approachable and always willing to improve on the software. You know, I think me and Antonio have got a lot of valuable information to bring to Porsche, and we've already started to imply and develop it to make the Porsche software even better. So that's really the biggest thing with Porsche, I would say. And then obviously, yeah, just the new car. That's such a different and powerful car now. You know, having the front motor, you know, full regen and the braking, it's a real different car to drive. And also just having different tires. I think that's really the biggest thing for at least us right now, is trying to get the biggest and best understanding we possibly can with the Hankook tire, and then to try and develop that into the simulator for the tire model. So honestly, I'm quietly confident that we can have a great season. I do believe we can win races, but you really don't know until Mexico. I think Valencia will definitely give us an insight of where we're at, but so far it all seems good. And yeah, it's just the cars themselves are so fast now in terms of like acceleration and, you know, managing traction. And then obviously the top speeds now are obviously much higher. So I think it will be very difficult for the driver, especially on the street circuits. I think all the places we've tested that, you know, you're not surrounded by walls. But I think when you go to like Saudi Sector 2 and like Rome Sector 2, it's going to be a serious challenge for the driver to keep the car in check in between all the walls. But ultimately, that's what everyone wants to see, and that's what the drivers enjoy. You know, we love a challenge, and I think it's going to be a good spectacular event at each one of them.
It's interesting you raise the tires there, because obviously, you know, the Formula E's run on Michelin since the series was created, and each individual tire producer makes tires in a slightly different way. What are your initial feelings about what they're like to drive on?
I think ultimately the Hankook does deliver less grip over one lap, and it's quite evident in just the terms of the tire wear itself. You know, last year by the end of the race they were almost slicks. You know, there wasn't really any tread left for the driver, hence why everyone crashed at New York. You know, if we've got any rain in the last sort of 15, 20 minutes of a race, we'd really struggle. Obviously, the tread blocks burning down during a race, which is dry, is good, because obviously then we don't suffer so much with thermal degradation. Whereas the Hankook seems to be much more robust. You don't really get this, you know, tread block wearing out like you did with the Michelin. So I don't think we'll see any instances like we saw in New York last season, which is great. Obviously, it is a bit dangerous that because ultimately it made having a wet and a dry tire merged together pretty pointless, because it couldn't cope with the rain unless it was new or only slightly worn. Whereas I feel like this year or next season, sorry, it's we'll genuinely have a tire which can do wet and dry, but maybe over one lap, the ultimate grip is slightly less than what the Michelin could produce. But I think it's going to be a great position for Hankook. You know, it's obviously something completely different for them. But there's going to be a lot to learn with the tire for next season. It's going to take a while to really learn what the best way is to warm it up, what the best peak of the tire is. Because last season was like 80K. The tire was sort of at its best. Whereas this season, it could be, you know, brand new. We could see that again. So it's going to be interesting.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be fascinating to watch the teams get their head around how to get the best out of them and the various bits of jiggery-pokery that they do in order to do that. Sam, as you mentioned, the expectations that come when Porsche do a project are sky high, and I think it's fair to say they haven't delivered against those so far in Formula E. But what have you heard about the test and development work that they've been undertaking ahead of season 9, and is this finally going to be the year that they do what we all expected when they came in?
Yeah, they seem to have done a lot of miles. That's what I hear. Jake's had some running, as he said. Lotterer, Da Costa, Wehrlein and De Silvestro have had a go in the car too. But we also know that they've had some test compromised by this battery cell issue. Porsche certainly had a positive test in, I think, Mallorca last month, which wasn't interrupted, as far as I know, or I hear, through any of those issues, which are ongoing with the spec rest in the car. So it's going to be interesting to see. They've got a fair bit to prove still in Formula E, that's for sure. But you know, with the spec issues that they've had with the battery and the ultra last minute nature of getting this Gen 3 project up and running, I think there could be a bit of a lottery element to the first stretch of races between Mexico City in January and then Sao Paulo in March. You know, we've got, I think there are 6 races in 9 weeks, so it's a busy start to the first Gen 3 season. I just hope that it's not compromised by reliability as much as is feared by some people that I'm speaking to at the minute. Porsche delivering, yeah. I mean, they have to, don't they? Their first 3 seasons, as we've said, haven't delivered what they expected. So, yeah, that's precisely why it was, I think, a pretty smart move by Andretti to get this deal done with them last year, because Porsche are, you know, Porsche are feisty. They want to deliver what they've promised the last 3 seasons. I'm expecting them, DS, and Jaguar to be right at the front. I think they've all done good mileage in, or as much mileage as they can in testing, in addition to their supply teams, of course, because don't forget, you know, for the Porsche Andretti axis, there's also Maserati and DS and Jaguar and Envision too. So as it stands, I think Nissan, Mahindra and NIO probably have some work to do. But yeah, intriguingly, you know, I'm hearing that NIO have had some strong tests as well. So going to be interesting to see if they're a dark horse next season. But yeah, I mean, Porsche and Andretti, I would say, will be in the mix. And I think, you know, Jake said that earlier, that they hope to be in the mix and they'll be winning races. It's going to be that question, isn't it, on occasion, of who's going to win. You know, we've seen the suppliers been beaten by their customers before. Envision have done it previously, in Venturi, of course. So it's that dynamic's interesting to see, and it'll be fascinating to see how Porsche handles that, because there are going to be days when, you know, Jake and Andre are beating Antonio and Pascal. That's just the way it goes in racing. And it's always interesting to see how the mother team, let's say, reacts to that. Porsche haven't had that scenario before in Formula E, so yeah, that's going to be worth keeping tabs on.
Jake, looking at the calendar, it appears quite top heavy with 6 races in 9 weeks, so really it's going to favour those that hit the ground running in Mexico, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Is that how many it is? 6 in 9 weeks? Jesus.
It's something like that, Sam, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
that is a lot. I do it yeah. Busy, but yeah, that's a lot, that is. But yeah, it's definitely going to favour the people which hit the ground running. No, I think the development will be fast, especially that start of the season, but you know, everyone's going to be making strides. But yeah, it's only going to, you know, work in your favour if you can, you know, get a good result in Mexico and then realise you've got a good package, and then obviously try and exploit that, because they will catch up, whoever it will be, especially like a top team. If, you know, someone like, I don't know, Jaguar do appear to be struggling, it won't take them long to turn it around. Yeah, 9 weeks would be pretty quick, but by that point, you know, you've missed 6 races. So, yeah, hopefully we're on the good end of that and we can exploit good results at the start of the season. But yeah, everyone's going to be pushing really hard in this first season, not just from our team, but also everyone involved in Porsche and every other team on the grid. Like you said, I generally think NIO looked quite impressive from what I saw at Verano. Because, it doesn't seem like sandbagging is so much of a thing in Formula E. You know, it's not like the junior categories or Formula One in testing. So their pace looked pretty genuine. And I'm just looking forward to seeing who on the grid has a good car. I think it's a really exciting time for Formula E, and we need to try and, you know, expose this and really get it out there to the public that we've got a new car and that we're here to put on a good show as well.
Well, another part of that good show is the little twist they've made to the sporting format. Sam broke the details of the story, but Jake, what are your thoughts on the way that attack mode is being slightly changed so that you can divide the time up that you're using full power?
Yeah, I read this article a couple of days ago, actually, from you guys. And it was, for me, I think it's great. You know, I do like attack mode. I'm glad Fan Boost is gone.
But oh, God, yeah, all of us are.
Yeah, I think we grew out of that in season, you know, 3 or 4, basically Gen 2. We didn't need that fan interactment anymore. I'm glad that's gone. But either way, the attack mode, I think it's just a different twist, especially if it'd be awesome if you could, you know, calibrate it during the race. So if, you know, they've done 3 minutes plus 1 minute, then, you know, you can do the opposite type thing, 1 minute plus three. So, it's definitely going to be a really cool feature. I'm glad it's stayed, that's for sure, because it is a great way to use strategy and path people. I'm looking forward to it and really figuring out the best technique for it.
Well, Sam, you scooped the story, so what do you think about it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a redrafted attack mode system. It's got a working title of attack charge validation. I'm not sure if that's going to be used. Actually,
that's going to be changed, you know. I guarantee.
And on Showtime, let's call it a working title at the moment. Yeah, I mean, I think it sounds good. I think it's creative. I think that it will give a lot of scope for different strategies, several different twists. Getting back to lap races, I think is good. The 45 minutes plus one lap just seemed to be unduly complex in the context of the race and the attack modes, and all kinds of reasons. I much prefer going traditional and going back to laps, in especially in single seater races. It's yet to be officially confirmed, just to caveat that, but this is what we anticipate to be within the sporting regs, which should be published very soon. The FIA is, just to go over it, just to give some facts to the matter of what we believe will happen, is that the FIA is going to give competitors options, essentially, of how attack mode activations will be used. So while the number of activations and durations of boost have varied up until now, race by race, they could only be deployed by drivers one way each time. So now there is, if this goes through, which we expect it to, now there will be a different scenarios, different possible scenarios and time combinations that all add up to the 4 minutes of additional power. So to give an example, this validation could be used as 3 times 1 minute, or 1 times 3 minute, or 2 times 2 minute in those combinations. Does it go far enough? Is it as exciting enough? Well, you know, the original attack mode was successful. It was popular. As Jake says, he enjoys racing in that format. So, why meddle with anything there? Let's just have a twist on it, which is exactly what they've done. It was, of course, supposed to go hand in glove with fast charging pit stops for next season. But we know now that that won't be in the start of the championship. You know, there's been a knock-on delay to that. But there is a possibility still that it will come midway through the season. Let's give it a few races and see. I think the only worry for me is that in a relatively short race, it might be difficult to illustrate what everyone is doing on TV, and it might just be too much to take in for the viewer. But yeah, I mean, a lot of people said that about the original attack mode, and in the last four seasons, and you know, generally we all know that Aurora do a great job in the TV production. The commentators, well, Dario and Nikki do, not sure about Jack, but nah. They do a great job of describing it. So let's see. It sounds good fun, and I think there's a lot of scope for some really exciting racing next season.
Okay, well, as well as testing an IndyCar, Jake, I hear that you also made your Nordschleifer debut in a BMW M4. I mean, that seems even further away from anything you're going to encounter in Formula E.
I've actually been planned to do a few Nordschleife races this year with BMW. I am still contract with them, even though we didn't do too much this year. But just the way it worked out with some of the Nordschleife races being cancelled, it meant it just got delayed. And a crazy experience, something which was one of the biggest challenges I've ever had. You know, it was the typical Nordschleife weather of just wet on slicks and then slicks on wet and not being able to see at certain times. And
how many cars out there?
Look, thankfully it wasn't one of the bigger races, so I think it was still well over 100, but
amazing.
it was still a lot. felt like I was passing a lot of cars. But it was much easier than, you know, obviously when I took my license, when I had to learn to get the license, when you're in one of the slower cars, you know, you're looking in both directions with that car, that BMW M2 I was in. You know, you're looking for the GTs, which are coming up behind you quite quick. And then you're also looking, obviously, ahead because you're passing slower cars. Whereas the GT, which I drove the other week, you just need to focus on basically going forward. So that was much nicer. You know, you're not constantly looking in the mirrors. And it obviously didn't really work out the race. We had to basically stop on the first lap after the start of the race and remove all the leaves out of our radiator. So we were pretty much out of contention directly. And then we had another failure, which was sort of out of our control before I'd even jumped in at this point. Nevertheless, when I finally got to drive, it was one of the best experiences I've ever done in motorsport. Just the new M4 GT3 combined with, you know, a semi-confidential Yokohama tire and the Nordschleife, it was just literally a pleasure to drive. You know, I didn't have any pressure from anyone really, because we were out of the race basically, and I could just enjoy each lap as it went by. And you know, I got better and better, and towards the end we were basically the leader's pace, which I was surprised about. You know, you go there thinking that you're going to be multiple seconds off, which you are initially, but you know, if you just gain a tenth per corner, you're around about 20 seconds quicker. So yeah, just learning. I had to relearn where it went when I first went out. I couldn't really remember. I was too busy. I couldn't do any simulator work beforehand. And I was like, I actually can't remember how this track goes entirely.
But it's really quite narrow in places as well. Any sort of dodgy moments?
Yeah, I had my fair share of moments, that's for sure, especially slicks on a wet track. And they said they couldn't believe I hadn't driven the new M4 by this point, the team I rocked up for. They were like, okay, so when was the last time you drove the GT3? And I was like, I haven't yet. So my first time out on it was in the dark, wet or slash damp on slicks. And that was an experience to say the least. You know, the last thing you want to do is crash the car just in practice. So there was a lot to take in. But the next day was a bit easier because the race was completely dry. I could just properly get into the rhythm of everything and just enjoy it. It was a great experience, and I definitely want to do more next year. I'd love to do the 24-hour. I think it's going to be tight with timing because I believe it's in May this year. Looking forward to it and working with BMW again next year.
Oh, brilliant. Well, yeah, the 24 hours, just an insane event. And some of the sights you'll see in the campsite, if you get a chance to wander around, really are quite phenomenal. But Jake, we can't have you on this podcast without mentioning Jake Dennis Struggles. For those of you who might be unaware, this is an absolutely marvellous Twitter account that deals with the sort of unfortunate incidences that before Jake in his domestic life. I mean, not that we're going to, you know, dob you in or anything, but it did take us 20 minutes to get this podcast going because you couldn't get your laptop working. But
I had to swap my laptop out, but there in the end, just 20 minutes behind schedule.
Is this a fair reflection of your life? Are you really that?
Yeah, very much so. This year has been by far the worst. I have no idea what or who I possessed to have this many delayed flights. I honestly think I had 95% delayed / cancelled flights.
Right, so we have to find out what his travel schedule is and don't go on any of those planes.
Yeah, honestly, if you're on the same flight as me, just literally book one an hour later and you'll get there before me. There was times where it was like 7-hour delays, 30-minute delays, and then obviously connectings. My first flight was always delayed, so then I'd miss my connecting. It was just an absolute disaster. And then that's just flying. And then there was times where my taxi drivers were always crashing in it when I was in it. So they were just crashing into the people, and you got to like delay because they have to do the insurance stuff. And it was just a struggle. And now it became that bad and that often. the fans and the public have taken it upon themselves to make a Twitter account. And it's honestly the admin on it is a lot, you know. They're constantly posting, but
are they like following you around? Are they spying on you? They're meant to get the info from.
Maybe they seem to know more than what I do, but yeah, they're actually super funny, and some of the content they come up with is a lot funnier than what I could ever think of. So it gets really good interest, and yeah, Jake and his struggles, go check it out on Twitter. You'll have a laugh, that's for sure.
Sam, this is making your Soul Taxi and Lost Phone debacle look small fry. So you got to raise your game, mate.
Yeah, do you know what? The one I saw recently was of Jake climbing up his flat or a villa or something.
Oh, that was an Ibiza for my holiday.
That was a good one. He sort of takes off his... I remember you taking off your rings and your necklace thing and then shinning up a drain pipe to get in his villa.
That was quite a jump, that. That was pretty tall. That was a good, like, 12-footer. I had to go drag the dinner table from inside, outside, and then launch myself up. And thankfully, I just forgot to shut my bedroom slide door. Otherwise, he would have been locked out and all my mates were still in Ushuaia until probably God knows what time. And it was thankfully I managed to jump up and get in, but otherwise it would have been a bit of a disastrous night to sit outside. Yeah.
Wouldn't have fancied explaining that to Roger and Michael if you fell off that balcony while you couldn't do the test
in New York. Imagine. I would have said I'm out running and I broke my ankle or something like that.
Oh, yeah, but Jake Dennis' struggles would have dobbed you in. You know, you'd have blown your cover.
Yeah, that is true. That is true.
Yeah, you need to get a deal with them. If there's anything that confidential, you know, hold on.
I know, right?
Sam, right, okay, just before we wrap this up, I guess there's a little bit of news. Where are things with Gen 3 at the moment? Because we know we've documented the troubles that it's been having.
Yeah, race against time, really, to get everything ready. There's certainly delays on getting all the parts to teams to build their race cars, but it's getting there, slowly but surely. But it's going to be tight. You know, we're talking 3 weeks until Valencia, and then essentially it's 3 weeks to Mexico because everything gets shipped out to Mexico City immediately after the test. So, yeah, massive pressure to get everything up and ready. Additionally, there's the issue with the spec battery supplied by Williams Advanced Engineering, which we first reported in September. What we know is that the cars are running generally reliably, but only up to a point on some tests where it appears that some oscillations cause an issue, which is allegedly seeing some of the cells leaking. That the cells were actually changed earlier this year as the original ones weren't quite up to the specification of the tender, which was won by Williams Advanced Engineering, and the new ones were fitted and were better, but seemed to be fragile in some circumstances. We understand solutions are still being sought, but it's not just clear at the moment how reliable they're going to be, especially further down the season when duty cycles are reached and you know, the miles are ratcheted up. So it's, you know, of course this car is a big step from Gen 2 to Gen 3, and these units are much lighter and they have to deal with much more demand and stress. This has been part of the reason why the fast charging will not be part of the sporting format from the start of the season. Then we could see it from sort of Berlin Monaco time, or they may choose to delay it to 2024. So there's a whole load of issues, problems to address in the next 2 months before we even go racing in Mexico. But you know what racing's like. It's somehow it's all right on the night, as Dennis Norden once said, shall we say. But it just seems to come together, doesn't it? And the big hope is that this will come together. But there are certainly, looking further on, there are questions from the teams and the manufacturers in particular as to how this project has been run, because there's been multiple problems and there's going to be a feeling, I think, next season of still learning about this car. There was always going to be that, but I think it will be above and beyond what was anticipated with some of these problems at the moment.
Talking of the FIA, there's been a bit of a furore, let's put it, as the man behind the Gen 3 project, Frederick Berton, has made a move to Mahindra. I guess that's not been universally popular, Sam.
No. To say that, to quote one team principal who shall remain nameless, it's gone down like a knackered lift, i.e. not at all. So it's caused a bit of a... The thing is, you can't deny somebody changing their career, and you can't deny somebody switching to a different, you know, the other side of the fence, poacher term gamekeeper, whatever you want to call it. But this was a big surprise, and it's a surprise because of the timing. We're going to a new rule set, and Frederick Bertrand has been integral and extremely powerful in terms of getting Formula E up and running and ensuring that it's had the success that it has. At the same time, someone so senior leaving to become a team principal when there is a lot of privileged information, not necessarily technical, but more about the makeup of the teams, particularly the financial regulations, which came into effect on the 1st of October, then you can see why people are surprised, let's say, about this move and the pace of it. So we believe, or we've been told, that he will start just before the Valencia test. As far as we know, he's still working for the FIA, or he certainly was as of last week. So that is, you know, mid-November or the first 2 weeks of November. And taking meetings or being part of meetings as an FIA representative. So there's a bit of, I don't know, let's say crossing streams there. And that is what is contentious about this. And I think some of the people I've spoken to on or off record, I mean, Roger Griffiths was great in being on the record about his opinion on it, and so was Florian Modlinger from Porsche, that some questions need to be asked, and potentially in the future, does there need to be a structure or some legislation that that precludes such a fast-paced change in, you know, going to see if the grass is greener on the other side? I mean, that's not for us to call, but certainly I think that at the Formula E teams and manufacturers meeting in Valencia that potentially some of these questions and these queries might be raised.
And finally, it wouldn't be a Formula E podcast without Sam's calendar update. So what's going on with all these to be confirmed races then?
Yeah, this must be what, the 652nd edition of Sam's calendar.
I've absolutely lost count now, but yeah, so well, we're up there.
Yeah, I mean, we expect an update in December. That's when the next World Motorsport Council meeting is. The Formula E Holdings are trying to get an alternative in Seoul, but that is going to be very challenging. I think the Jamsil area where we raced last August is not going to be available because of some building work that's going on there.
Yeah, they've decided to renovate it 30 odd years after it was built for some unknown reason, right?
Yeah, they have. And I really enjoyed, you know, Jake really enjoyed it because he was, you know, he had some great results there, but I just loved being there. I thought it was a terrific place. And that model of racing around major stadia and exhibition centres and so forth, you know, we've talked about that before, haven't we? There is a feeling that is going to be much more prevalent in Formula E, to save disruption to city centres and to have some events around iconic stadiums. So yeah, if they can get something else in Seoul, then that will fill the May date, but it looks like they may instead look for another doubleheader to plug that gap if they can't get an alternative to the Jamsil Olympic Stadium area. So let's see. I mean, Hyderabad has been mentioned to me recently as possibly becoming a double. Formula E senior race makers were out there last week looking at the track and the location for that circuit. The US race, which, you know, has been a major disappointment, that there is a potential of not being a race in America, and that particularly will be so for Avalanche Andretti, of course.
I just completely agree with Sam that we really need to, I think, hold on to the American dream, as they say, but no, the American track. I think obviously Formula One have done a really good job of capturing, you know, the American market with obviously Drive to Survive and just Texas F1 event is massive. And I think to even have a year away, you could potentially lose the fans we have out there and easily be forgotten. And yeah, I just think the American market at the moment is really enjoying motorsport. So yeah, but yes, it's obviously a shame we don't race in New York anymore, but nevertheless, to lose America entirely would be a great shame for everyone involved, to be honest.
Yeah, I was in Kota, and it's one of the busiest, maybe even the busiest F1 race I've ever been at. You know, it took an hour just to get out of the paddock. There were so many people there.
Yeah, I mean, should Formula E not be able to get a US race? I think it could be that Rome, I've heard that Rome could move back a little bit to plug that gap in June, late June. But yeah, let's hope we can get to the US wherever it is. And a quick mention for Tokyo. We found out recently that there's going to be a demonstration of a Gen 2 car in the city close to where they want to have the race in 2024. So that's a good move. That's a good positive step. And Sakon Yamamoto is doing the demonstration. Hero and star of Battersea Park in 2015, VW. You remember that?
Hopefully, there is a lovely wide piece of road for him to drive back.
I've never seen so much carbon fibre behind a pit before, but God bless him, he was entertaining that weekend.
He certainly was. Brilliant, thanks for the update there, Sam. Some more really good stuff, and don't forget to check out all of Sam's Formula E latest on the-race.com. Thank you so much, Jake, for joining us. I hope there are no struggles for the rest of the day, and we wish you the very best for the Season 9. And we'll be back with another episode ahead of the Valencia test next month, I think. Don't forget to check out our other podcasts from Formula One, MotoGP and IndyCar. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
The Athletic.